You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the History Hotline, the hottest line for all things Black history and beyond.
Mr. Howe, if I can just ask you, you are not a stranger to riots yourself, I understand, are you? You have taken part in them yourself.
I have never taken part in a single riot. I've been on demonstrations that ended up in a conflict. And have some respect for an old West Indian Negro and stop accusing me of being a rioter. Because you won't tickle me to get abusive. You just sound idiotic. Some respect.
Darkest Howe.
Grandchildren.
Thank you very much for joining us from Croydon. Darkest Howe, their writer and broadcaster.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 73 of the History Hotline. My name is Deanna Lynn Cook, and I, as always, will be your host today. If you haven't already realised, today's episode is about a fantastic man, one of my heroes, especially when it comes to fighting for the rights of Black people in Britain and against the injustices of the state, the one and only Mr. Darkest Howe. Now, that clip that I shared, I just feel like epitomises his personality, his oratory, his eloquence, the way he carried himself in the media and, you know, in regards to fighting for the rights of Black people, not just in Britain, actually globally as well. And that clip was just the pinnacle, because the way he was antagonised by the media, the press, and people in society, and his response at the face of that throughout his life, you know, from his arrival all the way until he unfortunately passed away in 2017, that is the way he carried himself. And that clip for me just epitomised it, and it just had to be shared. It also is one of my favourite moments of all time, because as much as I, you know, have a lot to say about the London Metropolitan Police, and nothing's changing this episode, we'll be back with them. But the BBC, following last week and their nonsense with the minstrel show, if you've not listened to last week's episode, tune in. But this was a moment where the BBC really tried him. You know, they tried to accuse him on live telly, on BBC One, of, you know, being part of a riot in the past. And so excusing the riots in 2011 and kind of suggesting that people were right to be rioting on, like, the BBC One channel, you know, in primetime news time. Later on, the BBC had to apologise, and rightly so, because if they had only known the true outcome of the Mangrove 9 case, which you all do because you've all listened to episode 1 and 2, they would have understood that, you know, he was never charged with, he was charged, but he was found innocent of, quote-unquote, inciting a riot and a fray, because the prosecution were biased and showed signs, as the judge said, of racial prejudice. The Metropolitan Police were described to have been doing that by the judge. And not to get bogged down with that case before we get into it, because we're going to get into it, because whilst we have done an episode on the Mangrove 9, Darkest Howe's role in that was instrumental. It was monumental. And his life was just incredible. Now, we can't speak about everything that he achieved in his life, because this podcast would take me 7 days. But please don't feel hard done by if there is a moment in his life that isn't kind of captured in this episode. I can't speak about it all. I will be going through the kind of a highlight reel, I suppose, of the main events and using some clips to help me out along the way, just to narrate some of the moments. And I think with Darkest Howe, his speech, you know, his oratory, his, and I hate to use the word eloquence, but he had some interviews and was faced with some questions by the press that I think anyone else would have either cracked, crumbled, or just gotten really angry, because they are such pointed and accusatory questions, and he regularly faced questioning like that at the hands of the police as well. And so for me, the fact that he manages to keep his cool so often, and we'll, you know, get into some of those interviews and some of those moments, but just really speaks to his character. And he never rose to the level of those that were antagonizing him, I feel. He was very level-headed and he knew the message he wanted to put out. And despite what people were asking him or accusing him of, he was going to get that message out. And that BBC clip just epitomized that for me. So I had to share it right at the start. And, you know, if you're ever having a bad day, just go and watch that interview. Just Darkest Howe BBC interview. It will make your day, because it's just, oh, the way he just holds himself. Ah, oh, I love it. Anyway, I have a lot of love for Darkest Howe. You will be able to tell by the end of this episode. And this is an episode I've wanted to do for the longest time. So, I mean, it feels like an honour to be speaking about him and his life and all he achieved. So, Darkest Howe, born Leighton Rhett Radford Howe. Darkest was a nickname that caught on. Was born on the 26th of February 1943. On the island of Trinidad in a place called Moruga. He arrived on the SS Antilles at Southampton Docks on the 11th of April 1961, got the train to London Waterloo Station with the intention of studying law, which he did. However, after 2 years, he left the Middle Temple because he wanted to become more involved in journalism. He arrived in Britain as an 18-year-old, so as a student, ready to study the law and become a barrister. In 1969, he actually returned to Trinidad, where C.L.R. James, who, you know, I've spoken about him before, the literary genius and writer, who's actually happens to be Darkest Howe's uncle and mentor, inspired him to combine his writing with his political activism. And he worked in Trinidad for a weekly newspaper as an assistant editor on a paper called The Vanguard, which was the newspaper of the Oil Fields Workers Trade Union. So he was becoming involved politically in trade unions and the kind of journalism and writing that was involved with that. So very political and very much on a level of activism on a platform, you know, of the working class and working people and looking at their rights in Trinidad. Shortly after, he migrates back to Britain. And at this point, you know, he's of working age, and like other Caribbean men at the time and newly arrived immigrants, he struggled to find professional, well-paid work, despite being so well-educated and qualified. You know, this man has studied the law, he's got a background in journalism and like the experience to back it up, but struggled to find work, just like many other men and women at the time. Because of racism and this kind of superiority that British people felt they had, because qualifications gained overseas were deemed as like not good enough or not at the standard, when in actuality, those countries were still colonized by Britain. And so were still under British kind of forms of education and higher education, and were following the same exact teaching that British people in Britain would have been having. But, you know, we've talked about that before on episodes, and it's a problem, but it was an issue faced by many. Now, he lived in Notting Hill initially, where we've spoken about the Notting Hill riots and Carnival, of course. In that part of London, there was a very large West Indian presence. There was also a large white working class community. And these communities, in some ways, mixed well, in other ways, did not at all. There were clashes, racial tension at the time was really high. And it was kind of during this time that he worked as a journalist for Hustler, which was a paper published for West Indian residents in the area. So he continued his writing and he continued on with his journalism. And that was something he did throughout his whole life, journalism and writing, and later on broadcasting. Darkus was inspired by the likes of Malcolm X, who he met in 1965, and also Kwame Ture, also known as Stokely Carmichael, who he met in 1968. And of course, his uncle and mentor, C.L.R. James. He believed and he advocated for black working class people and believed that they would be the agent of change. And that was kind of similar politics and a political line that his uncle had. And so he kind of was inspired clearly in his work by that. And so his activism and his journalism took place all around the world, and it was used to garner support for Black Power movement and for the working classes. And then we kind of fast forward to 1970 now. Ooh, we know what happened in 1970. The Mangrove Nine trial situation all went down in West London. He was arrested on charges of incitement to riot and affray. I would say, if you're here right now and you're at this moment and you're thinking, what, who are the Mangrove Nine? What's the Mangrove? Go back to episode 1 and 2 and have a listen. An in-depth analysis of the Mangrove situation that took place in the early 1970s. It was a restaurant in the Mangrove owned by a man called Frank Critchlow, who was also a fellow Trinidadian, and they were subject to harassment and repeated police raids, looking for drugs, looking for illegal activity. They never found anything ever, yet they continued on over 6 months. They were raided, you know, multiple times, to the point where they would struggle to do business because raids were happening so frequently. A protest was organised in part by the Black Panther movement, of which Darkus Howe was a part of. And they, you know, wanted to do a peaceful demonstration on behalf of the Mangrove restaurant to stand up for the restaurant, for Frank, for his family, for the community, and for everyone that was facing this harassment and brutality at the hands of the police. And so, you know, the protest turned violent, and the question was, well, who caused it? Was it the police or was it the peaceful black protesters? And then, you know, who's responsible and who would be going to prison for this? Now, this is where we kind of rewind back to that clip at the start where I assume the BBC reporter was alluding to this moment when she said, "You're no stranger to riots, Mr. Howe." You know, when that was exactly the opposite of what had happened. They did not go out there to riot. It was a peaceful protest that turned a bit sour, to be honest. And in the trial of this case, Darkus Howe, he showed up and he showed out, to be very honest with you. He was acquitted, like most of the others, of the serious charges, and the trial became the first judicial acknowledgement of racial hatred on the side of the Metropolitan Police. Now, it was in this trial where Darkus Howe represented himself, following the kind of influence of the American Black Panther Party, who would do things like this in trials. It was a show trial. You know, he performed. He has his legal knowledge. He trained, as we said, at the start of his life in Britain as an 18-year-old. He knows the law really, really well. And he's able to defend himself and also really draw the jury and spectators' attention to the falsehoods that the police and the prosecution were trying to push. And I'm going to share a clip of kind of one of the ways he did that in the trial, which was just brilliant, genius.
"Where did you see all of this? We were in an observation van." I said, "Bring the observation van." The lawyer said, "Darkus, please, exhibits are two-edged sword." I said, "I have nothing to lose. Bring the van." So they bring the van, and there were these slits at the back. There are four policemen seeing the same thing from the same slit. So I measured it quietly while the judge and they were wrong the side. and went home, cut out a piece of paper, foolscap, the size of the slit, recalled the witness, and said, tell me how four of you could see the same thing at the same time through that slit. He said, my eye was here, Reed's eye was here, Roger's eye was here, and the next eye was here. So it was your face. And that is what eventually broke the spirit of the prosecution.
Darcus absolutely, by defending himself, was the star of the show out of the nine defendants. And with Shakespeare quotations and all sorts of things, he stood up in the dock and was extremely impressive.
Darcus was a fearless warrior in the struggle against racial injustice in this country. People talking about civil rights movement. There was no civil rights movement in this country. There were anti-racist struggles were being waged, and Darcus was at the heart of that. He was at the center of it.
So there we have it. That was Farouk Dondi and Linton Kwesi Johnson speaking after Darcus Howe, who were also members of the Black Panther movement and also, friends and allies and worked with Darcus Howe throughout his life and his career. Farouk Dondi was a commissioning editor on Channel 4 and commissioned one of his shows later on in the 1980s and 90s, worked in broadcasting. Obviously, Linton Kwesi Johnson is a poet, and we've spoken about his poetry before. I can't remember on what episode, but I definitely have. I think it was... No, it's lost. I've lost it. But anyway, thinking about Darcus then in this moment, and bringing up this idea that four policemen could not have seen the same thing outside of the inside of the van through the tiny slit that Darcus, recreated and showed to the jury, and absolutely made the police look like idiots, let's be honest. He says, so if you all had your eye up to that little slit, where was your face? Absolutely ridiculous, but he played them at their own game, really. And he used his ability to speak eloquently, to draw in that audience, and to, pretend essentially that he was performing, like Shakespeare was performing a sonnet or, a play. He really got into role, into character, and sold that story, the truth, and made them look ridiculous in the process, which was absolutely genius. Another thing I wanted to bring up about the Mangrove Nine and that situation was the fact that a lot of the people that were arrested in this trial would have been part of surveillance that was happening under this special branch desk, where, leaders of this quote-unquote Black Power movement were being watched and monitored. And it seemed to be the case that they were being watched and people were waiting, and by people, I mean the police and the Home Office were waiting for them to kind of even put a toe out of line by way of protest or by way of speaking out of turn so that they could kind of clamp down on them. They were being watched. They were under surveillance. And this moment shows that, because the fact that these individuals were picked up and they were all quite prominent within these movements at the time. But then following the trial, for me, it seems like Darcus, by representing himself and taking on this kind of role of really trying to make the police look stupid, as well as proving his innocence and the innocence of the others, he maybe puts a target on his back. He becomes a centre in some ways, as Linton Kwesi Johnson said, of movements for equality in Britain. And that is a huge target, especially in the 1970s at that time. And, he's a journalist, he's a writer, he eventually gets into broadcasting. But I often wonder the kind of pressure he might have been under, having done things like that in his lifetime and having been so vocal and so relentless in his quest for justice and how he spoke about that. He did not mince his words. He did not sugarcoat things. And we're going to play a clip now that thinks a little bit more about his work as a journalist, writing for Race Today as an editor there, and some of the times he was asked questions to kind of explain situations that were happening in the Black community, who he really did have the trust of and belief of as a leader at that time.
Mr. Howe, as the editor of a magazine called Race Today, you have recently published a document in which you say, we are uncompromisingly against mugging. We see the mugging activity as a manifestation of powerlessness. a consequent of being without a wage. Could you tell me what you mean by that?
Well, firstly, the statement is in response to what has been paraded in the press and by Scotland Yard on the question of the increase in crime among unemployed youth. The young people have begun the rebellion, refusing to work. They have received very little support from other sections of the population, as a consequence of which they must find money by these means. We say we are against those means, not because we are moralists, not because we are religious freaks, but precisely because mugging involves loss of life and liberty and a continuing attack upon that section of the black community, police brutality, prison brutality, a whole wastage of human creativity. That is why we were against it.
So this interview here speaks to two things. One of them is the fact that, as we've mentioned, Dark Sal, editor of Race Today, and this journalist is asking him these questions, you know, about muggings that are happening, and young black people are being arrested for it. But instead of taking that moment where he's asked about muggings and asked about the statement Race Today have put out, you know, saying, you know, this is wrong, you should not be mugging people, he doesn't just like throw in black people, throw them under the bus and say, you know, they're thieving, they're doing this, they're doing that. He uses it as an opportunity to go deeper and say, well, why is that happening? And in turn, actually speaks on the institutional racism and the discrimination that these young people are facing that means that they are turning to this and not excusing their behaviour, but simply highlighting the systemic issues within society that leads to this. Because at the end of the day, poverty breeds crime. Black people, white people, any colour, you know, there's been instances of this. You can take nearly any country in the world that has areas of extreme poverty. Crime levels are high because people have nothing to lose. They have no money. They need to find a way to survive. And that was no different to the case in parts of London at this time, where black people, black children who had faced disadvantages in the education system, then in the workplace, finding jobs and jobs that were suitable for their skill set and also what they wanted to do. You know, Darkus is actually illuminating all of these struggles, and just so cleverly, because by the time you listen to that art extract and that question, by the time I get to the end of it, I even forget the question the journalist posed and the kind of ridiculous nature of it to condemn muggings, because who's going to really stand up and say, yep, muggings are great, we should all do muggings? Well, no. By the time you get to the end of that, you think, all I was thinking about was the failings of the British system. I wasn't thinking about muggings anymore. And I think that just speaks to his oratory, the way he speaks, the way he carried himself, the way he was under pressure, faced with questions like this. And also his journalistic flair and what Race Today as a publication was doing in regards to the black community and the situation that they were faced with and some of the systemic issues that they were having to deal with at that time. Under Darkus Howe, as editor of Race Today, he was editor from 1973 to 1988. It was originally linked with the Institute of Race Relations, publishing more academic articles, but Darkus Howe, under his leadership, turned it into a more of a radical black publication. Its headquarters moved to Brixton with the help of Olive Morris, actually, and other then ex-Black Panthers who became contributors to this magazine and this publication. And he stayed in the role till 1985. And then he began to write a column. He became a columnist for the Evening Standard in the 1990s. And also, for over a decade, wrote for the New Statesman. So, you know, these journalistic skills he learned all the way back in Trinidad, writing for this trade union, carry him throughout his career to the 2000s, to the early 2000s. And, you know, this also coincides with his work in broadcasting, which is happening from the 80s onwards. In the 80s, he launched his broadcasting career working on Channel 4, regularly speaking on TV and radio. His first TV series was The Badung File from 1985 to 1991, and that was commissioned, as I said, by Farouk Dondi, who was a fellow member of the Black Panther movement earlier on. And I think at this point, Darkus Howe becomes even more vocal and even more called upon as a speaker, and not necessarily as a representation of the whole of the black community, but he was a great commentator on issues that were impacting black people and issues of race, racism and racial tension in Britain.
Howe was in demand as a commentator on issues of race and identity, whether discussing symbols of Britishness.
I love England. I like being here. I like living here. But I'm not a patriot. You could like the country. I love the countryside. I get along beautifully with English people. We are part of a space. But I am not a patriot.
Darcus Howe was often called upon to speak on issues that were happening. And he clashed with so many people in broadcasting, in terms of like on the air, on radio and TV, speaking about racial issues and things of that nature, because he just wouldn't budge. He's relentless. He knows what he believes and has evidence to back it up, and, you know, is not going to be bullied into any kind of position by anybody, you know, BBC presenter or otherwise. And I think that was one of the incredible qualities about Darcus Howe as a speaker. He remained this way, radical, outspoken, and in 2011, following the London riots, although he might call them insurrections of the people as opposed to riots, you know, he really spoke out about what was happening. And instead of getting bogged down with this idea of always writing wrong or right, which is exactly what the media did after 2020 and the Black Lives Matter protests. Oh, is it right or wrong to pull down statues? This conversation isn't about statues. This conversation isn't about whether riots are right or wrong. It's about the reason that we are in this position, which is racism, systemic and otherwise. And I find the media do that all the time when it comes to issues of race. Like, say, for example, there's a problem that causes protesting, it causes demonstrations. Then at those demonstrations, something happens that's unsavoury. We now think about the unsavoury moment rather than looking back and thinking, well, why did we have these turn of events to get to that unsavoury moment in the first place? This is exactly what happened. And Darcus Howe, every single time, calls it out. He doesn't fall into their traps of having to condemn mugging or condemn rioting, or if he was alive in 2020, probably have to condemn pulling down statues. He gets back to the root issue, and he kept, I think, the focus on the important things, and I really, really appreciate that from him. And I'm going to share a clip from 2011 from the interview that we started with, where he kind of goes into the actual issue, Mark Duggan's murder, and, you know, what that meant and why that shouldn't be glossed over.
You say you're not shocked. Does this mean that you condone what happened in your community last night?
I condone, of course not. What I'm going to condone it for, what I'm concerned about more than anything else, there is a young man called Mark Duggan. He has parents, he has brothers, he has sisters, and few yards away from where he lives, a police officer blew his head off.
Well, Mr. Howe, we have to...
Let me finish.
Mr. Howe, we have to wait for the official inquiry before we can say things like that. We don't know what happened to Mr. Duggan. We are going to wait for the police report on it. If I can take you on a little bit, you were talking about your grandson, you were talking about young people.
And he said it so well, Mr. Duggan is dead. You don't have to wait for an inquiry. He said, let me finish. Oh, he just, the energy he came with to broadcasting, to interviews, to speaking, to writing, is just so admirable. And even in his latter days, he passed away in 2017. He had prostate cancer, which was diagnosed in 2007. So he had lived with that the last 10 years of his life. You know, even during his illness, he took the opportunity to work with the NHS and Channel 4. He did a documentary over 6 months to urge black men to have checkups, as they were three times more likely to suffer from it than their white counterparts. Even in his sickness, and, you know, eventually as he passed away, the political gravity of the situation in regards to it being something that black men were more impacted by in terms of dying disproportionately, he even spoke up about that, you know, even in his sickness. he died peacefully in his home in Streatham, South London, survived by his wife Layla. He had 3 sons and 4 daughters. And he will be remembered, I hope, as an outstanding activist, a journalist, a broadcaster, but more importantly, one of the most powerful voices for Black rights in Britain, and one of the most powerful voices I think this country has seen. Always articulate, dominant, speaking with such pride, and relentless in his quest for justice through a variety of means. A fearless campaigner, consistently fighting the injustices of Britain and colonisation in other countries as well. There's so many more things I could have spoken about. His impact into Notting Hill Carnival. He was on the commissioning board. He had a steel band that played there, the Renegades. You know, so many other TV shows that he was a part of. Other publications that he edited and wrote for. You know, there's so much to say about this man. But if you take anything from it, I think his spirit for justice, for activism, for doing what was right, and for not accepting the beating that institutional racism and this British state could do to you as a Black man in this country at that time, he's an inspiration, truly, truly a great one. And may his memory and his legacy go on for a very, very long time. That is all I have on Darkest Howe, but I'm going to leave you with a clip. A fantastic clip of him speaking about Tiger Woods. It's not relevant in many ways, but, you know, anyone could get it from Darkest Howe, I think. It didn't matter. You know, he was on a quest for the right, for rights and for truth. So if you weren't with that, you could get it. So I'll leave you with that clip. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful week. Goodbye.
Utterly unbiddable, his own man, Darkest Howe wouldn't let anyone off the hook, no matter how celebrated.
We read the nation's headline, Tiger Woods, I am not black. Just as we were coming to grips with our new hero. Hang in there, brothers.
Thank you for listening to the History Hotline. If you've enjoyed this episode, please tell a friend to tell a friend. To continue the conversation about Black history, head over to our social media platforms at The History Hotline on Instagram and at The History HL on Twitter.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.